You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. Hey, Don, can I say that phrase for the next 3 months?
Sure. We will have some clouds coming in later in the week.
Okay.
So it's not going to be completely clear. But right now, as we speak, it is sparkling clear from horizon to horizon in the Sacramento Valley. Wednesday, March 11th, preparing the show for broadcast on Thursday, March 12th, 2026. Temperature right now is 50 degrees. We were low this morning of about 44, 45 degrees. And we're going up to a high of 75 degrees and sunny. Thursday, sunny, 79 degrees. Thursday night, mostly clear, 49 degrees. Friday, partly sunny, 79 degrees. Friday night, mostly cloudy, 51 degrees. Saturday, 82 degrees, mostly sunny. Saturday night, 55 degrees, mostly clear. Sunday, 85 degrees and partly sunny.
Oh, wow.
85 degrees. So we're, 20 degrees above average. Sunday night, mostly cloudy with a low around 58 because of the cloud cover. So 58 degree low temperature Sunday night. Monday, partly sunny, 87 degrees. Monday night, 58 degrees. Tuesday, sunny with a high near 87 as well. Weather Underground, which usually runs a little bit higher on temperatures, is telling us that next week will be 87 on Monday, 89 on Tuesday, 89 on Wednesday, and 90 on Thursday, the 19th of next week, and 89 again on Friday, with night temperatures mostly around 55 to 56 degrees. But it's warming up way faster than usual. In fact, we're having suddenly very spring-like weather, and I've already had a couple people say, isn't it getting kind of hot?
Is it too late to plant tomatoes?
Isn't it getting kind of hot? Got 7 feet pounding my head on the table. No, it's fine. Everything is lovely. It's a great time to start planning and planting your summer vegetables here. And also a lot of flowering things are coming in. We're getting a lot of requests, and this happens every year, for warm season subtropical things. You know, someone walks in and goes, you don't have any hibiscus. It's March. We really shouldn't have any hibiscus at this point, assuming you're talking about the tropical type. Can you get verbena? Can you get lantanas? Well, yeah, I've got coastal suppliers that have them just barely coming into bloom. Those are heat-loving plants. So, you know, there's always a lag between...
Come back in a couple months.
Come back in a couple weeks would be fine, but a couple months would be even better. Yeah, that's what we say about those subtropicals. Or if you don't mind them without blooms on them, absolutely fine. We got a couple announcements here to go through. What have you got in front of you, Lois?
Well, I've got this Gardens Got Natives tour. It's a tour of plants. There are 45 gardens on display.
45 gardens.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Featuring California native plants. And this is a free self-guided native garden tour in the greater Sacramento area. So you go and get your little list and tells you where to go and when things will be open and stuff like that. And it's all happening Saturday, April 18th, starting at 9:30 a.m. And then on Sunday, it also goes and they end at 3 p.m. So 9:30 to 3, Saturday and Sunday, April 18th and 19th. And you can get more information at
California Native Plant Society website page. So that's cnps.org, and click on events. This is the Sacramento Valley chapter of the California Native Plant Society. You'll find all kinds of other garden tours at other California Native Plant Society chapters around the state. The hosts will have plants labeled with both their scientific and common names, and will be available to answer questions the day of the tour. So you go to CNPS, that's CNPS.org, look for the Sacramento chapter, or just click on the events link there. This is phenomenal. 45 gardens on display. Oh, we've got a new program here at KDRT. We'd like to mention YOLO Backyard Bulletin, seeking to address the ongoing demolition of local media by the communications entertainment complex, which prioritizes profit maximization at the expense of local engagement and conversation. YOLO Backyard Bulletin features local news, commentary, music, gossip, true stories from YOLO County, with the goal of rebuilding and restoring community communications in our public sphere, which is the lifeblood of democratic life. You can listen to YOLO Backyard Bulletin from 5 to 6 p.m. every Thursday at KDRT 95.7 FM right here in Davis, California. We endorse that old adage, he says, if you don't like the news, go out and make some of your own.
I like that. Well, Don, just as we were starting, sent me yet another photo. And this one, I'm guessing that's a lilac.
That is the very first lilac. And I always make a point on some of these things, particularly lilacs, to go out and take a picture of the first day of bloom. The very first flower on this cluster of blooms had opened yesterday, March 10th. So I like to do that. One of the reasons I take a picture on the first day something blooms, especially a lilac, especially the same variety of lilac, is for the principle of phenology. Determining whether you can embark on certain garden practices based on when certain things are happening, like, you know, when the oak leaves are the size of a squirrel's ear, that kind of thing, the lore that you get from the old guy down the street that says, well, I plant my tomatoes when the oak leaves are the size of a squirrel's ear. And I'm
what
thinking,
kind of squirrel are you talking about?
That raises a lot of questions. It raises many questions. But when the lilacs bloom is something we can mostly relate to. And just out of curiosity, since we've had such strange weather this winter, is this earlier than usual? So I went back. It's about 4 days earlier than usual in terms of when it's blooming. Generally speaking, my very first lilac starts to bloom in the second week of March. And this one is about 4 days ahead of previous years. So lilac blooms, for those of you who are following along in other parts of the country and want to know where you stand with respect to our phenology here, that would be that our lilacs are about to bloom. I think yours in the East Coast are mostly May. I don't remember, but a little bit later than the second week of March. Yes, lilacs do well here, by the way. Lilacs do great in this area, and I often have people surprised to learn that. We get enough winter chilling for French hybrid lilacs, the classic fragrant lilacs, to do very well. I have several of them on my property, and we sell them because it's actually a great plant for this area. It's a plant that likes alkaline conditions. It's a plant that in the East Coast, I gather people apply lime to get the right pH for their lilacs. Yeah, don't need to do that here. Our water is high enough in pH that you don't have to correct the pH for lilacs. They like full sun. They're reasonably drought tolerant. They'll grow in light shade, but they're going to be prone to mildew if they're in any significant amount of shade. They bloom best in full sun. And we can grow the regular French hybrid lilacs here, the super fragrant ones. I also have a couple of the Descanso hybrids. These were bred at Descanso Gardens in Southern California and are tolerant of lower chill winters. So if you're down there and you want to grow a lilac, those are the ones you would plant. Here, they bloom mostly about the same as the French hybrids. I actually have one Descanso hybrid that I'm about to take out. It's a white flowered one, and it blooms in the fall every year, which you might think, oh, that's cool. No, it's not. It's weird. It blooms in the fall, and I don't really want it blooming then. And because it blooms in the fall, it doesn't bloom in the spring. It is so low chill. Apparently, it gets what it needs early enough that it just goes into bloom off cycle. But the Descanso hybrids are your best choices for Southern California if you're only getting 200 or 300 chilling hours in the winter. We get at least 800 chilling hours here. So French hybrid lilacs do just fine here in the Sacramento Valley. If you're in anywhere in USDA zone 9, you'll do just fine with lilacs. And they are actually surprisingly tough, adaptable plants. I wouldn't have known that, except that there were lilacs on this farm when we bought the place. There were some of the very few plants that the previous owners who had lived here for, you know, 60, 70 years had planted. They clearly weren't giving them any special attention. They were about 8 to 10 feet tall when we bought the place. They just basically never pruned them. You don't have to prune them, but then the blooms are all kind of out of reach. And we started watering them and they flourished. And I thought, okay, so I just started planting more. Lilacs do very, very well in this area, and they're wonderful to have for the early season bloom. When people walk into my nursery and say, do you have lilacs? We have to do an immediate, do you mean lilacs like your grandmother grew in Ohio? Or are you talking about ceanothus? Are you talking about the California plant sometimes called lilac, wild lilac, California lilac, and so forth? Totally different plant. Ceanothus is also blooming now. Some of them are past their bloom. Some of them are at their peak of bloom. They're a totally different conversation. They're called lilac, as is the case with many.
Because of the inflorescence.
It looks like it. Yeah, it looks like a lilac. It looked like a lilac to an Easterner who was naming it with a common name. Hey, this looks like the lilacs we have back home. People often get kind of upset about this in native plant groups. We shouldn't use those common names. They're misleading. I said, most common names are misleading. Most common names are, this plant reminds me of this plant, so I'm going to call it that. Star jasmine is not a jasmine, but it's called star jasmine. Common names also don't have any official legitimacy, so you can come up with any common name you want to. They're handy for common usage, but if you want a specific thing, helpful to have a picture of it, because then we can go, oh, you mean Ceanothus, and we can show you those.
Okay, so you said phenology, and I thought that was studying the bumps on your head.
That's phrenology.
What is phenology?
Right. Phrenology is determining your character by measuring.
It's a false science.
Pseudoscience. Phenology is the science of connecting naturally occurring phenomena with the weather. Gardening practices can arise from that. So, for example, when the forsythia are blooming, it's time to put down pre-emergent to prevent crabgrass. There's a really good example of modern phenology. Forsythias bloom at a particular time each year that's probably dependent on soil temperature. Seems to be predictable based on soil temperature. That's also when certain weed seeds germinate. In fact, the germination of certain weed seeds can be a really good guide to when to plant tomatoes, as an example. If pigweed's coming up in your garden, the soil's warm enough. The soil has hit at least 60 degrees because that's what pigweed needs to germinate. So if you know what pigweed is, this is really handy. Hey, that weed is coming up. Kill that. Plant the tomatoes. You're good to go. That would be a good example of phenology, using a naturally occurring phenomenon to guide your gardening practices.
I want to briefly, very briefly, go through when to plant seeds of various plants. And this is just a chart, an article that Don gave me. We're already past January and February. I won't go there. Tomatoes, you plant the seeds in March to early April, and then they'll go into 4-inch pots in about 4 weeks, up to a gallon size if necessary. Keep them moving so they don't get root bound, and then plant them out in the ground about the third week of April at the earliest. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a general recommendation. We don't even plant seeds of cucumbers, melons, or squash until you'd be within 3 weeks of planting them outside, which is May. So, okra, don't even bother. I mean, let me rephrase that. If you want to start the seeds in late April, then you plant them outside in late May or early June. And the other seeds that you can plant any time, basil, sunflowers, bush beans, and corns, they can be planted from early April all the way into late June.
Yeah, I recommend people think in terms of succession planting, and this goes for flowers and vegetables. Something I had to learn when I moved here from a climate that was very mild all the time. Okay, the temperature range in coastal San Diego, just like you folks on the coast of Northern California, you only maybe 10 to 15 degree temperature range over much of the season. And so you aren't quite as accustomed to a place where there's a 30 or 40 degree temperature range on a single day. Succession planting is something that I quickly had to adapt to. So there are things that can go in early, flowers and vegetables. And then you do another planting 4 to 5 weeks later of the things that really need heat. And you bear in mind the very first things you put in, let's say marigolds are a really good example. I always plant marigolds in and around the vegetable garden, not because of their purported benefits for preventing pests. I just do it because my dad did it and they're pretty to draw beneficials. That's why I plant zinnias and things like that. They draw beneficials in, hummingbirds will be out there, and it's pretty to go out in your vegetable garden. Marigolds do great here, June and July. By August, you're getting thrips and spider mites on them to the point that the plants can be pretty ugly. And people want to know what to spray. I say, don't spray.
Just pull it out.
Well, or cut them off or cut them back. Try this. I did this with dahlias. Same thing. Thrips are a big problem here. It's a native insect that goes on a lot of our garden plants. Dahlias were just coming into big bloom by the middle of July, and then you start getting thrips on the leaves. Let them do that big bloom. Cut them back. Throw all that stuff away. It'll flush out new growth and bloom again. Many things, and marigolds will often do that. They'll often give a second bloom. More to the point, about 4 weeks after you plant your marigolds, plant cosmos. About 3 or 4 weeks later, plant zinnias. Plant sunflowers every 2 to 4 weeks from late March all the way through August, and you'll get bloom from them all the way into October on the individual plants. In the case of sunflowers, it's a one and done thing. So it's just a few weeks of bloom on an individual plant, and then it's done. Well, you've got some others coming along right behind it. And I generally am doing the last plantings of some late zinnias, cosmos, one of my favorites for late summer bloom. I'm generally doing those plantings in late July, early August. But I do one last planting of sunflowers because I know they'll be blooming in late September, early October. That's the way to get a sequence of bloom. And the same principle, of course, can apply to some of your garden vegetables, but especially to things like basil. Basil comes up, you're using it when it's tender and young and vigorous, and then it starts to bloom and the flavor does become somewhat more acrid and less desirable on the classic sweet basil, Genovese basil. As it goes into bloom, it's less desirable. So you can cut it back and keep new growth flushing out, or you can plant new plants every few weeks from seed, or I guarantee nurseries will have them all the way through June or July. We carry them all the way into August. Or, of course, you can plant some of the new ones that take a lot longer to bloom, like the Emerald Tower series that I highly recommend. But if you happen to be planting traditional basil, plant it every few weeks. If you're into cilantro, you already know that you have to plant it every few weeks because it just flowers right away almost no matter what. No, we don't plant cilantro in the hot weather, but you could do your last planting of it now, mid-March, and then you do your first cool season planting of cilantro in October, and you do it every few weeks. So succession planting is really the key. Some people know it already for things like sweet corn, but it applies to many of your flowers as well. It applies to many of your kitchen herbs, the annual kitchen herbs like the cilantro and the basil. So just continue planting every few weeks rather than going out. This is the biggest mistake that I typically see. This is the weekend we're going to do the vegetable garden. The whole family comes down. Those are great fun, by the way. Loading up the flats with all these vegetables, going home and planting them, and then that's it. You probably should do some follow-up planting, especially the things that like heat, whether we're talking about flowers like Aegidium patiens or we're talking about vegetables like okra, which shouldn't even go in until the end of May. There are things that really need to be staggered, and some things you'll get better yield and better production overall if you stagger them as well.
So our listener, Emily, says, hi, Don and Lois. I was interested in your discussion of soil amendments the previous week. Can you discuss the difference between manures? I commonly see bagged chicken or steer manure for sale. When would you use which and which one? What are other readily available amendments do you recommend for growing vegetables and annual flowers in a raised bed?
Steer manure is very popular and has been historically because it's generally available in very large quantities at a very low price, often free. So that's one of the reasons steer manure became such a popular soil amendment. My father would go out and find the cheapest steer manure. It was a common loss leader in the nursery industry when we opened in 1981. The nurseries would have, steer manure, $2 a bag, and bags of sulfate of ammonia. And those were our loss leaders for people in terms of when we're selling something at or even slightly below cost in order to drive traffic. It was inexpensive. It is about 1.5% nitrogen. Could be less, but typically 1 to 1.5% nitrogen. And the important thing to know about steer manure is that it doesn't release all of that nitrogen right away. So it releases, my recollection of considerable investigation of manure release curves once years ago, is that steer manure releases about half of its nitrogen in the first season, and the rest is tied up in the fibrous material that is part of the steer manure and releases gradually over the next 2, 3, 4 years. So when you put down steer manure, much of it is available to the plants the first season. The rest is gradually releasing over the next few years. Well, if you incorporate it every year, you're building up this sort of reservoir of nitrogen storage there for subsequent years, as well as getting the benefits from the first year. But it's only about 1 to 1.5% nitrogen typically. So it's a long-term improvement, and it's actually a great thing to use, but it isn't giving all of what you think it is the first season.
Do you have to do anything to it other than turn it into the soil? I mean, like, do you have to compost it or anything?
No, just turn it right in. It's usually been composted when you buy it. You're not buying fresh steer manure. You're buying manure that's been piled up for a while and then brought to hopefully a reasonable moisture level and then put into a bag.
So would horse manure be the same as steer manure?
It's different.
It's organic and you use it that way.
It's lower nitrogen and takes longer. The nitrogen is more tied up and it's more likely to have weed seeds in it because of what horses eat or are fed. So it's very common for people who use horse manure to get grassy weeds coming up. Other than that, it's not a big problem, but horse manure does work. And for a long time, people had free source of horse manure in the Davis area because there was a farm to the west of town that gave it away. You come out there, they'll just load it in your truck. Chicken manure is double the nitrogen. It's about 3% nitrogen. And in fact, they'll sometimes claim that on the label, although that gets into a whole big regulatory labeling issue with the state of California. But they can pretty much say to you that chicken manure is typically about 3% nitrogen. It depends on how dry it is. It depends on a lot of other factors, but it's about twice the nitrogen. And my understanding is it releases almost all of that the first season.
Mm.
So that's a big difference.
So you're not building it up. Just eating.
And you're getting results quickly. So in my opinion, chicken manure is one of the very best fertilizers for gardeners to use because you get all your nitrogen right away. You do need to incorporate it. And there are health and safety issues with chicken manure. Chicken manure can contain salmonella, E. coli, things like that. So it's very important that you not use it around leafy vegetables or around vegetables that are going to be in contact with the manure. So it's important to incorporate chicken manure rather than just putting it on the surface. So you don't have that issue with steer manure typically. So you can just turn it in at the time of planting or ahead of time. Right now would be a great time to go out and buy some chicken manure, spread it on your garden, cultivate it lightly, water it, and then it'll be there. It'll be working its way in. It'll be exposed to direct sun. Ultraviolet rays do minimize the risk of contamination because that's one of the things that they do. They help to sterilize pathogens. And so that's something you could do 2, 3, 4 weeks ahead of planting, and that would be even better, even safer. But chicken manure does need to be incorporated. It's a better source of nitrogen for the home gardener in terms of giving its full release right away. So you get about 4 times the nitrogen out of chicken manure, even though it's only twice as much nitrogen by analysis, because it releases it all the same season. That means, of course, you have to apply it again next year.
Okay, so manure, mm-hmm. That's poop.
Correct.
So how stinky is this stuff?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Stinky
yeah.
stuff?
Yeah, I used to carry 30 or 40 bags of manure in the back of a Volkswagen Rabbit hatchback. And if it, it was a warm day, it definitely got to be a bit much in there. Yes. Yes.
What about other kinds of animals like cats and dogs?
We don't do that for health reasons. It's not safe. And things like pig manure, those are big pollution issues back where, you know, hogs are raised in large numbers. In general, rabbit manure, sheep manure is great. It's a rabbit manure is almost 3 to 5% nitrogen and releases reasonably quickly. And if you happen to be raising rabbits, you tend to have a fair bit of it. It's very discreet, doesn't smell bad. It's something that I'd probably just throw it in the compost pile. It'd be the simplest thing to do with it, but rabbit manure is great. Other animals, you're not likely to run across, turkey manure unless you're buying it from a turkey farm, duck manure, too wet to use, too gross, you're not going to be doing that. So I would say the typical choice is steer manure, chicken manure. Of the two, steer manure has more bulkiness to it, has more compost. So it gives that benefit to the soil, but it takes longer to release the nitrogen. Chicken manure gives you everything you need the first season, but it's mainly just nitrogen. It's not giving you all that bulky stuff that you're getting from the steer manure. They're both good. Both are quite economical sources of nitrogen. Just remember with chicken manure, you got to be careful how you use it because of the slight possibility of contamination.
I'm sure there are other things because I've heard of things like guano droppings.
Oh, yeah. Bat guano. And, sure.
And,
yeah.
And worm castings. And
okay. Let's
stuff.
Take those.
How does one find out all the different kinds of manure?
Oh, that's a complicated subject, but I'll take those two. Worm castings, for example, are considered to be about 3% nitrogen. That was what we were told by a worm grower years ago. They won't put it on the label because when they test for it, it's variable, anywhere from 2% to as much as 5% is what I'm told. The problem with putting anything on the label, let's say you're routinely getting 3% nitrogen, you go, okay, I'm going to sell this as a 3% nitrogen fertilizer. California Department of Food and Agriculture periodically goes around to nurseries. They've come into my nursery a few times over the years. They buy products off the shelf. They test them to see if they meet what they say on the label. If it doesn't have 3% nitrogen, you're in trouble as the manufacturer. If you're the retailer, they just say, pull it. You can't sell this. Fine. You know, we just send it back. But if you're the manufacturer and you're saying it was 3% nitrogen, it's only 2.5% nitrogen, your label isn't legitimate. Therefore, you can't sell it. So they're very, very careful since it's a a natural product with variable nitrogen content that depends on the moisture content, the temperature, a lot of other factors as to what it's exactly going to test for. You're not going to see that on the label, but I can tell you that worm castings are considered to be about 3% nitrogen, and they are very different than the other manures. They're not a fluffy thing at all. They're like dirt. They're basically like soil.
Yeah.
And so they have the advantage of retaining moisture to some degree. They release over the course of one season. My recollection is that worm castings, mostly one single season of release, but they're not making the soil fluffier. However, worm castings are very, very beneficial way to fertilize. They're just rather expensive. Guano, seabird guano and bat guano are commonly used in many of the products we sell. Now, EB Stone and Son Company that we buy all of our bagged products from has a bat guano, seabird guano combination. They call it a fertilizer charge that they put in many of the products. It's in some of the soil amendments. It's in even the one that they just sell is essentially not an organic compost, but a garden compost like a soil amendment. They put a small amount of it in there even. Those are 9 to 10% nitrogen. And they're relatively wet. So an important data point about manure is the wetter it is, the faster it releases. So these are relatively wet when they go in. So you get the benefit of bat guano and seabird guano the first season. And it's three times the nitrogen of chicken manure and even higher than that relative ratio to steer manure. So that one of the reasons they're using these is they're fast acting. They're a good source of nitrogen. They're not something you're going to be finding. Bat guano, that doesn't sound like a very fun job, harvesting the bat guano. Seabird guano, same thing. These are harvested in the wild in a regulated manner, but it is something that's being wild harvested, essentially. They are a great source of nitrogen, and it doesn't take very much to make a bag product essentially function as a fertilizer. So for example, the recipe 420 that a lot of us are selling, you can guess from the name what it's primarily for. They've incorporated bat guano and seabird guano into that. I have customers, and I've done this myself, where they'll just take some of that and turn it in the ground where they plant a tomato plant. And that gives it all the nitrogen it needs for the season because it has enough of those two particular types of organic nitrogen in it that they can provide a full season's worth of fertilizer.
And that doesn't have the salmonella issues like the chicken manure does, do it?
I don't know for a fact. I mean, chicken manure is coming from factory farms, and so you have just a higher likelihood. But bat guano and seabird guano should be handled with care and should be incorporated, in my opinion. So in general, if you're using animal byproducts, it's best to incorporate them, and it'd be great to do that a little bit ahead of time. Traditional has been to spread out 2 to 4 inches of steer manure across the whole bed, rototill it in March, and plant in April. That's a great way to go. If you do that every year, steer manure, I calculated this at one point, 5 to 7 years in, the residual nitrogen you've been incorporating is probably enough for a whole season at that point. So you don't really have to do it absolutely every year. But, you know, it was something that was done. Clean out the stalls, spread it out in the sun, let it dry a little bit, disc it in. We don't do all that stuff anymore. We don't rototill the vegetable garden every year because we know that's breaking up the soil web and doing harm to the mycorrhiza. But in the place where the actual plant goes, put a little heap of it on the ground there, turning it in with a shovel, watering it, letting it mellow for a few weeks isn't a bad plan right now.
So Emily finishes off her comments with, what do you recommend for growing vegetables and annual flowers in a raised bed? I mean, she's talking about what amendments mm-hmm. do you recommend?
Well, we sell a product that's 15% chicken manure. It's called fir mulch. It's a fir compost, fir meaning it comes from fir trees, not fir of animals. We have to explain that frequently. The company that made this product, EB Stone & Son, Greenall brand, put the name fir mulch on it 70, 80 years ago. And over the years, they've tried repeatedly to put out, because that doesn't, you know, most people go, fir mulch? What? I don't understand. Does it have fir in it? It's from fir trees. Fir, Douglas fir is not, it's not even the regular fir. Douglas fir is our lumber tree on the West Coast. So the byproduct of the lumber industry is fir sawdust, which can then be piled up and turned into fir compost or fir mulch. And then they add 15% chicken manure to that. So that is our standard that we sell for vegetable gardens. It's already got the chicken manure has already been composted, so it's safe. It's blended in, so it's a relatively low rate. You can take this and spread it out wherever you're going to plant vegetables, and it's actually a great soil amendment. That's why we happen to like to sell that one. And I've had customers buying it for years. Every now and then, they'll try and put it in another bag with a different name. I remember Soil Booster. That was It's the same exact product. We brought in a pallet of that, put it next to the pallet of fir mulch. The pallet of fir mulch sold in 1 week, and it took us 6 weeks to sell the pallet of soil booster. So our answer was, we're going to stick with fir mulch, folks, even though that name is confusing.
Or put a sign up that says,
the same thing.
New name for fir mulch.
Didn't work. And they still have soil booster, but we stuck with fir mulch. So basically, a compost blended with manure is a great thing to add to your vegetable garden, and it is a good thing to do each spring, and here in California, each fall as well. So each gardening season is a good idea to top dress and or incorporate, depending on how you're managing your vegetable garden, to get some more nitrogen in there. The reason we like it with organic material is that helps to retain moisture and retain the nutrients and release it to the plant through the season. So just buying a few bags of whatever brand you prefer, spreading it out at the beginning of the season, remembering that we have two full gardening seasons here. And for raised planters, this is really important. We've been going through a process since the pandemic, 6 years ago, sparked a huge interest in vegetable gardening, and a whole lot of people built raised planters and filled them with imported topsoil, which is basically sandy loam, very sandy, emphasis on the sandy part of sandy loam. Drains fast, okay, that's great, but doesn't hold nutrients, doesn't hold water. So the way you can make that into a functioning, viable garden soil is by repeatedly top dressing with organic material that retains the moisture and the nutrients, and even better if that organic material contains a source of nitrogen. So you can do them separately. You can buy bulk
soil booster.
You can buy bulk compost that's going to be labeled something like ours is Harvest Bale. I mean, there's funny names on them, but they're basically just compost. And you can buy the nitrogen separately, either as a fertilizer or manure, whatever you prefer. Or you can buy the combination products. And what you're going to do will really kind of depend on how much you need, because it's more expensive to buy the combination products. But if you only need a bag or two, that's the way to go. If you've got a big garden and you need high volume, then you'll get some kind of compost delivered, or you'll get big bales of more economical, just compost, and you need to supplement that with nitrogen. That's the point we keep trying to make. For example, I just noticed, came from the city of Davis, they've begun the compost giveaway at the city dump. They do that from March through into October. You can go out there and you can, on certain days, and you can get a whole truckload of their compost. And it is truly compost. They brought it to a certain internal temperature. It's been broken down, but it's just compost. It doesn't have nitrogen added. It might have some nitrogen in it, depending on what went into it. That depends on what people were putting out for the street, for the city to pick up. So it's all kinds of stuff in there, but it's not typically got a lot of nitrogen in it. So that's fine if you want to use that. Top dress 2-3 inches of that across the top of your raised bed is fine, as long as you add a source of nitrogen. So if you're looking for and finding economical sources of compost, be aware they probably don't contain enough nitrogen. And a more common thing I run into is, oh, your plants needed fertilizer. Well, I make my own compost. Your own compost doesn't have nitrogen in it. Unless you're adding food scraps, like meat, things like that, protein sources, if they're going into your compost pile, then you're adding some nitrogen, but not much, honestly. If you're just putting leaves and lawn clippings and things like that, you're generally not putting much in the way of nitrogen in there. So what my dad would do, and I highly recommend this, is some of that cheap steer manure he would buy would go right into the compost pile. Just top dress the compost with it, throw some more dirt on top, so you're adding nitrogen that way. If you're spreading it all out on your vegetable garden boxes at the beginning of the season, do the compost. Do some source of nitrogen, water it all down to get that whole connection with the soil below going, get those mycorrhiza growing, emerging up into that compost, and get it breaking down. And then you can turn it in as you plant the plants, and it'll be right in the root zone, giving them what those young seedlings need.
Yeah. So Don is always sending me things. Lots of times they're articles or they're warnings or whatever, but every once in a while he'll send a picture. Yes. And this picture that I'm looking at as a ribes, bright yellow, lovely bright green yellow flowers.
Yep.
Bright yellow.
So a ribes with yellow flowers has the botanical name Ribes aureum, A-U-R-E-U-M. And when you see that,
means yellow.
It means golden, technically. So when you see that particular name, at least tells you that the flower is golden. And this is commonly called the golden currant. It's native to California. Native to Canada and the central United States west of the Mississippi River, but has escaped cultivation and naturalized in the eastern United States. You folks have it back there, too.
Does this one go dormant in the summer?
Is it? No, this is like others. If you don't water it at all in the summer, it will lose a lot of leaves and look kind of stressed, and the plant is perfectly fine. That's how it adapts to lack of irrigation. But with just any kind of watering. I mean, really, it doesn't need much. It will stay foliated during the summer, which is an important thing to know. If you're designing with California native plants, some of them have a summer dormancy and estivation, if you will, responding to drought. And ribes are kind of famous for this. The plants are fine. They'll just drop a lot of leaves and look kind of rough. And so if you're a designer and your client is okay with that, you're already planting things like buckeye, which drop their leaves in August, then they'll be fine with it. But this one could be in the light shade of a bigger tree, which is where mine started. It also is fine in full sun. It could be irrigated like a regular landscape, and it will look lovely and foliated all summer long. It will adapt to drought, but it is fine with irrigation. So it's one of those kind of plants. And if you look at the distribution on CalScape, it's mostly around the valley, not in the valley. It's more in the shelter of trees and places like that. Let's see what they say here in terms of CalScape. On the coast, it prefers full sun. Inland, it prefers part shade, does best when surrounded by mulch, and grows well under oaks and in mixed chaparral. This is my plant that I sent a picture of. We put this in at least 35, 40 years ago. It has spread to be a thicket about 10 feet across. Some of the ribes will do that. It is, looking out the window, 8 to 10 feet tall at the maximum height. I've never pruned it, so it could be kept lower with no problem. For a long time, it was about 5 to 6 feet tall. I've noticed it's mounding up higher and higher now as time goes by. It started in the shade of a walnut tree, which grew fine under a walnut. That's an important data point for those of you trying to deal with walnuts and the fact that some things don't grow well under them. We had to take out that walnut tree about 10 or 15 years ago because it was declining. And so we removed it, and suddenly the entire backyard was in full blazing hot sun. I just made sure this plant got some extra water, and it was just fine with full sun right here in the Sacramento Valley in the USDA Zone 9A. So it is okay with full sun as long as it gets irrigated. If it's going to be kept drier in a more xeric landscape, then it probably should be in partial shade, but it's one of the toughest, most adaptable of the ribes for the interior, has been my experience. The yellow flowers come on in the spring. Golden currant is quite beautiful when it's in bloom. Hummingbirds absolutely love the flowers, interestingly. And while it doesn't set a lot of fruit, it does set fruit. And the berries, I've tasted them. They're a little astringent to human taste, but I can assure you that the squirrels really like them.
And the birds love them.
The birds presumably love them, but the squirrels,
I think, if they last as long as to midwinter.
Yeah, they hang on there for quite a while. In fact, it says here, the fruit is an important food source for many bird species, as well as small mammals like squirrels and chipmunks. They're also used in
rats.
I didn't say that, but yes, it's true. Pies, preserves, and other dishes. That's hard for me to imagine, but it is an edible fruit, and certainly the wildlife will appreciate it. Requires no care whatsoever. Ours went through a litter of puppies. I mean, at one point many years ago, one of our dogs had puppies, and we had 9 puppies in the backyard. Nine. Pretty much everything out there got trashed. Okay, once you've gone down that road and you're keeping them long enough to find homes for them, and we found homes for most of them, but the backyard became the dog yard. This plant was fine with that. I mean, they trampled it to the ground. I put a little fence around it. It came right back. It has taken full sun, full shade, dogs, watering, not watering, you name it. So I consider this to be one of the most adaptable of the current group, the ribes genus, Ribes aureum. You can find it at some nurseries. Native plant nurseries very commonly have it in stock. And their comment here, spreads readily. Yes, I agree with that. It definitely makes a thicket rather than a singular shrub. So that's something to be aware of when you're planting this one.
And it's a California native, which so many people are looking for, not really understanding native where. But this one will do it.
Yeah, the CalScape maps are great. One of the things that's funny about them, they'll show locations where actual herbarium specimens have been collected and identified. And it mostly is on the sides of the valley, around the Bay Area, for example, over in the Coast Range, in the foothills. And I'm always amused when I see the one spot near Sacramento. That was Davis. And it probably wasn't a native specimen. It probably was an herbarium specimen, because UC Davis has an herbarium. But it certainly is fine in the foothills around us, including the east side of the Coast Range, which is dry. So this is not a plant that needs, you know, wine country type of rainfall. It's actually quite fine with lower rainfall. It just drops its leaves earlier. It likes to be mulched. It likes to be irrigated, but it doesn't absolutely require it. And the ribes in general are great background plants for informal California native landscapes.
Dear Don, now that it's likely that most of the rains for early 2026 are behind us, I have a burning question about watering. I live in a rental duplex in North Star, that's in Davis, with a sizable corner yard filled with grass and shrubs around the front of the house. The landlord pays for the mow, blow, and go guys who come by once a week. That's a landscape service. I have sprinklers on a timer. What is your recommendation for how many days of the week and minutes each time? They're a rainbird.
Yeah. I need to know, in order to answer this question, I would need to know what the output is. And so the very first thing we need to know is how much water you would be applying with this system. So I can't give an exact answer. She's running it presently three times a week, 15 minutes at a time, could be 20. That doesn't seem like long enough to me, but I don't know what the output is. So the reason I wanted to put this up here, of course, we'll talk about watering more as we get further into the hot weather. You need to know how much water your system is applying. And if it's pop-up sprinklers, there's a really easy answer to how much it's applying. You can measure it. You can take tuna cans or cat food cans, work just as fine, well, or cake pans or any, you get the idea, straight-sided cylinder. And put them out there, put several of them out. Put them out in the places where the lawn is doing well. Put them in places where the lawn hasn't done as well. Put them over by the shrubs and see how much water you're getting in the 15 minutes or 20 minutes that it's running. Because you're going to need to give 1 to 2 inches of water a week, okay? 1 to 2 inches of water a week for most plants. So you need to measure the output. 2 inches would be the high end of things. That would be typically your lawn. I would love it, absolutely love it, if most people in the Davis area and similar climates could get to the point where they're watering the woody plants, the shrubs, the trees, most perennials, your fruit trees, once a week really thoroughly. Once a week really thoroughly, because you'd be giving a deeper watering. So instead of three times a week for 15 minutes, once a week for 45 minutes would be better. Same amount of water, but all applied at once, so it penetrates more deeply. It would be even better if all those woody plants were on their own valve, so they're getting watered once a week deeply, and your lawn is getting watered, let's say, twice a week, a little more shallowly. 3/4 of an inch twice a week would be great for your lawn. Once a week deeply would be great for your shrubs and trees. I'm already off in the weeds here, okay? We're already getting into complications, but the complications, I don't know what your output is. If I have the sprinkler brand, we can calculate it, but it's easier to just measure it. So this is a good time of year, and the reason I wanted to bring this up now, it's a good time of year to turn on your sprinklers, make sure all the heads are working. They tend to get plugged up in the winter. Make sure they're spraying correctly. Measure the output. And if you've always had problems with like the high part of, you know, the lawn's got a mound, it's got a high part that thins out or a corner that never looks as good, I'll bet you'll find that that area gets less water than the rest of the lawn. They're never perfect in their distribution. I've designed sprinkler systems. There's no way to make them absolutely perfect because lawns are not geometric. They're irregular shapes. So that's the first thing, is determine where you might have problem areas. Make sure they're working. See how long it takes to put 1 inch of water out. That's the key question I'm going to have for you. And then if you can do a little less than an inch of water twice a week for a conventional lawn, that'll keep it looking healthy. That's more water more frequently than your woody plants need. I'd rather have them deeply watered once a week.
Given that this is a rental duplex, I'm not sure she's going to have the ability to make all these changes.
Possible. If she controls the timer, great. If not, then you do have an issue, and I do run into that.
But I mean, when you're saying split them up from this one,
right? It may all be one. It might all be on one system, in which case you're just going to have to compromise. And when everything's on one line, it's very important if you're designing an irrigation system to zone by the water use of the plants, hydro zones as they call it. Your lawn, your flower beds, your vegetables need more water more frequently than the woody plants, the shrubs, and the ground covers and stuff that are around. So it's great if you can have it split at least in two different programs, and most timers will accommodate that. I just find that most people aren't running it long enough. 15 minutes is almost certainly not long enough to give any of the trees and shrubs a deep watering. If you're doing it three times a week, okay, you're giving them kind of barely what they need, but it would be far better to water them deeply. And another option, if you don't have control over all of that, is about once a month, just really deep water the trees especially, but also the bigger shrubs by moving a hose around or putting a soaker hose in or something like that and running it for a few hours if that seems appropriate to your soil. North Star, which is heavy soil, because it's pretty high clay content up there. So it's quite possible that you can't water deeply all at once because it tends to run off. If it's coming out more slowly, if they're low pressure, you know, low gallonage heads on the lawn or a drip system on the perimeter, then you can get the depth of watering because that'll put it out more slowly. The soil can absorb it, but it has to run for a long time. Drip systems need to run. I can't think of any drip system on my property I run less than 2 hours. And this is the way we get the depth of irrigation is by running it for a long time to really soak in. And then you should be able to go a week or so between waterings. The exceptions, turf, most kinds of conventional turf, vegetable gardens, flower gardens need more water. You know, flower borders need more water, but the woody plants and the tougher perennials, once a week thorough soaking would probably be great. It's challenging to give one answer because everybody has a different distribution system. So the first key question, the reason I want to bring this up now, is you need to either measure or calculate the output. One other thing you can do, if you've done all this and you've got this all figured out, you're trying to figure out how to water less and more effectively, the day after you irrigate thoroughly, especially as we get into further into the dry season and the rainfall stored moisture has been used up, the day after you irrigate, go out there at some point, take a shovel, take a trowel, and dig down and see how far that irrigation actually penetrated. If it's 15 minutes, I'd be surprised if it's gone more than about 6 to 8 inches deep, which is okay for grass, I guess, and fine for flowers and things like that, although it would be better if you were watering more deeply, but it's certainly not enough for a woody plant. So I really want greater depth of irrigation, and that's something you need to follow up on with a soil probe or a shovel or a trowel or something the day after you've watered. It's had a chance to soak in and redistribute, see what kind of irrigation depth you got. I want woody plants watered to a depth of 18 inches. Every time you irrigate, if you possibly can do that, you may be surprised how long that takes. And sprinklers are not the optimal way to do it, but if that's what you got, that's what you work with. It may mean with heavier soils, you do two different start times on the same day. If 15 minutes, it starts to puddle, and I'm telling you to run it for 30, two 15-minute settings on the same day are better than 15 minutes a couple days apart, because two settings on the same day will water to a greater depth and be better for the root systems.
When you were talking about shading things, it brought to mind what this listener wrote. And this is Rebecca, who is in, I don't know where. I'd like your opinion on whether using this kind of chicken run would work as deer and critter protection for raised beds. And she sends a picture. I am looking for an alternative for installing deer fencing and then figuring out a cover to keep squirrels and birds out. We have intense deer and squirrel and mole vole pressure.
Good Lord.
And motion activated sprinklers work pretty well, but I need a more of a barrier type solution.
Okay, let's back up there. First of all, motion activated sprinklers are really an interesting option. You can buy these and they will, I'm told they work pretty well with deer.
I think
if deer are really hungry, they're going to come in and eat just about anything. This is not something we have experience with here, thank goodness. You mentioned mole/vole pressure. Moles don't harm plants. They're blamed for a lot of things, but moles themselves are insect feeders. So they can tunnel around and be annoying in that regard, but moles themselves do not feed on plants. Gophers certainly do. I can tell you all about that. And voles do. And it's a shame that mole and vole are such similar common names for rather different animals. Vole is another name for a meadow mouse. It's a large, somewhat flattened mouse that's kind of cute. Actually, I have a lot of them on my property. Generally speaking, voles are not a huge problem, but we can have years where their population spikes for one reason or another.
Live underground, don't they?
They live in grassy meadows, which is what my entire farm basically is a grassy meadow. But voles mostly are not a big problem, but you can have years where they suddenly can have big outbreaks. Moles, yeah, they're just tunneling along, feeding on worms and grubs and things like that. So they're basically beneficial. The disruption to the soil can be annoying, but they're not doing any direct harm. Deer and squirrel, oh boy. Okay, go on.
Okay, so she's looking for a barrier style solution. Building an attractive or proper fenced in garden out of wood or even T-posts and cattle fencing is cost prohibitive, and I don't have the skill set anyway. But this kind of fabricated chicken run is modified a bit, if modified a bit, seems it could work. Well, people on forums give it a thumbs up too, but I'd like your expert opinion. For your listeners, it's a 13 by 10 foot metal frame with a domed roof. It comes with a door and includes chicken wire to cover all sides and the top. You can find similar things by searching for some combination of words, chicken coop, run, walk-in cage, whatever.
Yeah. I think this is great. This is really one of the simplest ways to go is you can buy something that's prefab like this. I had another customer, he wasn't dealing with deer, but he built his raised vegetable planters and he had set posts and he just left the posts. He bought 8 foot posts and he just left them 8 feet, 6 feet up out of the ground. And he enclosed it with that just by buying the wire mesh. But this is something that comes all ready to go. This is basically like buying one of these pop-up greenhouse type devices. And this would work great. Make sure that the chicken wire that you choose is dense enough. You're probably not going to actually get chicken wire. That's my concern, is whether it's big enough to keep the voles out because they can get through a pretty small hole. Other than that, I think this is a great idea and it looks sturdy. It looks reasonably well made and it would be pretty simple to install. So I think this is one option, just a physical barrier, just making sure that your wire mesh is going to be substantive enough to keep out even fairly small rodents such as meadow mice. You may need to secure it down at the bottom somehow because it's pretty easy to push under. If I'm looking at this picture correctly, let me see what the bottom. They don't have.
It goes into the ground.
The state, yeah. Well, it looks like it just sets on the ground, so it wouldn't be hard. It wouldn't be hard for an animal to crawl under that. But just make sure that the wire mesh extends down far enough, and you may wish to go out and get some of the wire staples, they're called, although and you might want to just pound those into the ground to make sure that that wire mesh at the ground level isn't open enough for something to crawl under. I think this is a really simple way to go. And a lot of people are getting very frustrated with tree squirrels here in the Davis area. You just need a physical barrier. I don't have a repellent. I don't have a product you can sprinkle on the ground or anything like that that really works on tree squirrels. Physical barriers are the way to go. I mean, I'm sitting here as we chat to do this show and I'm looking at two tree squirrels running around my backyard right now, digging in the whiskey barrel that has flowers in it. I'm going to have to go out and clean that up after we get finished with this portion. I have learned the hard way that if I plant something and I want to protect it and it's in a barrel or something like that, I need to put a wire screen over it for at least the first week or two so they don't just go in and dig up what I planted. So physical barriers are really the answer for almost all vertebrate pest problems.
Okay. Let's move on and talk about avocados. Don says he has questions every day about avocados.
Just
so
about, yep.
Here is a recap of the issues.
Okay, so this is we do get a lot of people asking about avocado trees. Obviously, everybody loves to eat avocados and they want to grow their own. And in 1 week, we actually got every single day at least one person walking in and asking about avocados. And the question was something like, I heard that in Northern California, we now have some avocado varieties we can grow, or something like that. So there are very few wholesale nursery growers of avocado trees in Northern California. Actually, there's really only one in Northern California, Four Winds Growers. Availability is really never sufficient on avocados. They take a long time to get to a saleable size. There are growers in Southern California of avocado trees, and some of them ship up to Northern California. But most of those growers grow Guatemalan varieties. Like if you buy an avocado in the grocery store, that's the Haas variety. It's 98, 99% of the avocado industry is Haas. And it's not
in
hard.
The summer. In the summer. In the winter, we get these Mexican imports.
In general, the only ones I've really seen in significant numbers in the store are the Guatemalan avocados. Mexican avocados are not generally sold in grocery stores. But
this is from Mexico. Isn't that a Mexican avocado?
Not necessarily. In Mexico, they grow the Guatemalan varieties.
Oh, this is getting sorry about that.
We're getting a little confusing here. So the best known variety, Haas, and many of the others that you've heard of are Guatemalan varieties. Oh, at 30 to 31 degrees, they'll be badly injured. And we get
that every year.
Pretty much every year. Yeah, this year we only got there once, but it would have been enough to do some damage to Guatemalan varieties. I want to interject here. The dwarf avocados you've heard about are all Guatemalan types. So they're not hardy here. They're dwarf, which means that they're more like a shrub than a tree. So you could grow them in a big container, like a barrel, and have it close to the house in a sheltered location. So if you wanted to try a Guatemalan avocado variety here in USDA Zone 9A or 9B, Sunset Zones 8, 9, or 14, You want to try a dwarf one? Well, find that microclimate, like we always talk about, south side of the house, east side, under an overhang. Put it in a barrel so that you can move it if you have to. Prepare to cover it if we get below 30 degrees, which does happen here every couple of years. The availability of Mexican avocado varieties, which are the types that are hardy enough to grow here once established, important phrase there, is limited. Briefly, those are Mexicola, Mexicola Grande, Stewart, Zutano, and Bacon. Those are the five varieties that I consider cold hardy enough to grow in the Sacramento Valley. Mexicola.
Once established.
Mexicola Grande, Stewart, Zutano, and Bacon. Once established. Yes, the young trees, if it's just green wood of any avocado is vulnerable to cold injury. Once it's gotten woody wood, like the second or third year, even if the green wood is damaged by cold, you know, an unusual cold snap, it'll resprout from the woody portion. So that's why I say once established. The young trees are heat sensitive and the leaves can sunburn in a heat wave. So plan to shelter them from afternoon sun. So shading the young trees, and more importantly, the bark is very, 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 very vulnerable to sunburn. If the trunk gets sunburned, you've got a big problem, and probably you'll have to replace the plant at that point. They often grow fine, but don't bloom for as much as 5 to 10 years. Very commonly, the first year that they bloom, first couple of years that they bloom, most of the flowers will fall off without pollination. You don't actually need type A, type B for cross-pollination. You'll read all about that. That's really not an issue here. It's simply that young trees often just don't set properly and hold the fruit. So it can be several years before they finally fruit. Once avocados do start to produce, you'll find that every kind of fur-bearing mammal that lives near you likes to eat the fruit. We had a giant Haas avocado in our backyard when I was a kid. I mean, we had avocados on the ground all the time. And we would find that if an avocado fell from the tree and hit the ground and we didn't pick it up that day, if we went out the next day, something had eaten half of it. And we figured out pretty quickly that it was a skunk. Skunks absolutely love avocados. Possums love the fruit of avocados. Tree rats love the fruit of avocados. So the summary is that availability is a problem. The cold hardy types are the least available. Most of the types that are sold are not cold hardy. Avocados can be challenging to establish and they take a long time to start producing. Experiment to see if you can get an avocado to do well here. Compared to Southern California, where you have so many choices of varieties that you could actually have avocados from your backyard year round. And I would strongly recommend Greg Alder's blog. Alder, Greg Alder. He knows his avocados. He knows which varieties do well in Southern California. Highly commend Greg for his very informative blog. And he'll give you information about which varieties do well, which ones don't do well, how to get a whole sequence of ripening so that you can literally have avocados year around if you're in Southern California. We don't yet have a Guatemalan quality avocado for the Central Valley or Northern California.
Gardeners are by nature an optimistic lot. They gladly sink money, effort, and time into a plot of land with no guarantee of the return. Planting a garden is truly an act of faith in action.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.